Welcome back to Embrace the Grain Photography Podcast. I'm Sherry Christensen, and I hope you'll enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 49 of Embrace the Grain. Today we have a super special guest and an episode that is maybe a little bit different. Today I have with me Brian Caparici. Hi, Brian.
Oh, and you pronounced my last name right too, Sherry. I'm so impressed.
I told you I listened to your podcast.
Like Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and happy to chat about this stuff. This is going to be fun.
Yeah. So thanks for coming on. So why don't you start out by telling everybody a little bit about you?
A little bit about me. Well, let's go back. It was a cold afternoon, November 17th, 1987. No, I'm kidding. I've been a professional wedding and portrait photographer here in the Niagara region in Ontario, Canada, for about 15 years now. And have always loved, you know, the creative side of photography, but more so, and this is, I think, what sort of sparked our conversation, Sherry, is I've always had a passion for the business side of what we as photographers, professional photographers, what we do, marketing and sales and branding and, you know, all those kinds of things that typically creatives don't necessarily love, because we love the art of what we do. I've always had a passion for, in addition to the art of what we do, also the business of what we do. And so that's kind of led me down a really fun journey as a photographer. You know, I've made a living with my camera exclusively for 15 years. And my wife has been able to be a stay-at-home mom with our three kids because of the money that I've made with my camera. You know, we bought our house and we've owned vehicles and sort of had the creative, or the not creative, the financial freedom, the financial creativity, I suppose, to be able to you know, do what we want to do with our kids and with our life and with our marriage and with all the things that we have. And I attribute that to the success that I've had because of the money that I make with my camera. So I realized, I mean, early on, maybe 10 years ago, that a lot of photographers don't think that same way that I do. Like they are really good photographers, and these, you know, many of my friends and beyond, but they're great photographers, but they just don't like business. And so I sort of took to teaching business to photographers, and have had a lot of fun with that, a lot of success in helping other people with their businesses. And about 7 years ago, I sort of had this light bulb moment sitting in my studio. I was trying to manage all these different moving parts in my business, from, you know, bookkeeping to galleries to delivery to contracts to invoices, all these different business functions in my photography business. And I was managing them in different places, and I found it really complicated, and it was giving my clients a sort of disjointed customer experience. And I was less than organized using all these tools that were supposed to help me get organized. And so I had the idea for having, you know, building this one system that would do everything a photographer would need to do in one place. And having a computer science background, I understood what you can do with technology and what you can do with programming and software and things like that. And so I set out to start, build, found, and create and launch now what is Sprout Studio. So Sprout Studio sort of is one tool that any professional photographer would need to do all of the business side of what they do. And that has sort of, that's a long background into sort of where I am today. Still, you know, obviously photographing, and photographing a lot less, obviously, because I'm the CEO and the founder of Sprout, and I've got a team of 8 that I manage, but definitely still doing a bit of both. And about a year and a half ago, I totally randomly stumbled into this wonderful world of analog photography. I had never shot on film before. I've always been a digital shooter. But whatever it was, it just pulled me in, and Sherry, you know, hook, line, and sinker. I'm all the way.
I do.
I'm all the way in, as listeners know. So that's the sort of long and winding road to get to where we are today.
Yes, I know all about that. That is pretty much exactly what happened to me.
Yeah.
Hook, line, and sinker. I'm in it.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where it's just so fun, you know, because there's so much to love about it. There's so much to enjoy. And I think what for me, what was really attractive is, you know, for at the time, for 13 and a half years, I had been photographing professionally with digital cameras. And it was great. Like, I mean, I've always enjoyed it, but like it was second nature to me. I could photograph a wedding with my eyes closed. I could operate the camera with my eyes closed, and it was good and it was fun. But getting into film, it was just like there were so many other variables. You know, there's so many other creative choices, and there's so many more pieces of equipment that we can have for so much less that we can tinker with and play with. And you know, these cameras that we use are beautiful tools. And so it's just kind of opened up this whole world. And then, you know, getting into developing myself and darkroom printing, and now I'm getting into Super 8. And it's just fun. It's just a lot of fun. And it's just very different than what I've done for 15 years as a professional.
Right, right. Yes. I did have at one time a business, and I went out of business because, one, I didn't need two full-time jobs. Hmm. Because that's too much work.
Yeah.
And then when it starts to get that much, it takes the joy out of things.
Yeah, you know, it's tricky. It's like as soon as you and I've always said that in my career, as soon as I stopped loving what I'm doing, I said I'm going to close the business down, because the whole point of being an entrepreneur and the whole point and, you know, doing photography full time is because I get to make a living doing something I love. And as soon as I stop loving it, I've always said that I would shut it down. And for me, honestly, Sherry, like photographing on film has like re-sparked that joy and that passion and that interest in it in a way that for me, digital never had.
Right, right. I still love my digital, but it has a very thick layer of dust on it, and 90% of the time the battery is dead. Mm-hmm. I went to use it last week and I went, oh, one bar, that's enough to get the one picture I need. And
that's
then
hilarious.
I thought, well, I better charge it up again.
That's but, funny. It's like, you know, here in Ontario, in Niagara, where we are, right now we're in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. And so where we are, we haven't been able, as professional photographers, we haven't been able to be out in photographing. So I've had weddings canceled, portraits rescheduled, everything. And we just had that ban lifted about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, at the time of this recording. And I had a maternity session, literally the morning that it had been lifted, because I had a client that was waiting because she was expecting. And it's just funny because
you are on a time crunch.
Yeah, there's a time crunch. And it's just funny because I literally hadn't touched my digital camera in 4 months, like ever since the beginning of the pandemic. And then before then, it was the winter time here. And in Canada, obviously, there's not a lot going on in terms of photography and weddings and things like that. So it had been a long time. And I had to kind of be like, I need to kind of refamiliarize myself with this camera because it's been a while since I've touched this.
So I have to ask you, would you say that like the COVID-19 has really impacted you, or has it allowed you to diversify a few things?
That's a loaded question. I mean, I think that's such an interesting conversation. For me personally, it has not had as big of an impact on my career and my lifestyle as it would have if I was exclusively a professional photographer right now. So I still am running Sprout. The entire team is working remote right now because we can't be together in the office. But I'm still very, very busy on that side of things, on the education side of things. In fact, when the coronavirus pandemic first hit, I was doing Facebook Lives for our community and doing webinars and writing articles every single day to basically try and help professional photographers in our community and in the industry sort of weather this storm, because photographers were hit in a really, really big way. So we were busier than ever during it, but that's because I have Sprout and because I'm educating photographers. If I was just photographing, it would have more or less sort of screeched to a grinding halt. It would have been, you know, very, very challenging. And it has been very challenging for professional photographers. But for me personally, it's been busy, but it's given me just sort of like a break, like a pause, sort of a breath of fresh air, a change of pace. And I've been photographing and documenting this with my kid. My wife and I, we have three kids, been documenting it all on film. And I've only been shooting film probably for the past 4 months up until that maternity session. And so, yeah, I mean, creatively, it has challenged me and inspired me to see differently and to photograph differently and to force me to slow down in my own, you know, daily pattern. But that's, again, because I have the luxury of having Sprout still to run and to keep paying the bills.
Right, right. Yeah, I was kind of curious on that. Okay, so let's get into the questions I had thought up. So if you were a hobbyist photographer and you were thinking of maybe starting out a business, where would you start? Where's the first place you would start?
First place to start. I would start to think about what kind of photography you want to be offering. It's something that is, it seems like it's common sense, but oftentimes it's not. You know, if we can have someone that can throw us a couple of dollars and in exchange for that, we can use our camera. That's exciting. And the idea of that is exciting, but it's going to be difficult if you don't really understand who you are, who you're photographing for, and what you want to photograph. And so in that sense, I would do a bit of thinking on that. You know, do you want to be a wedding photographer? Do you want to do portraits? And if so, you know, what kind of portraits? Do you want to do family, or do you want to do newborn, or do you want to do commercial? And even in that, let's say you want to do family, do you want to do like studio, like style post portraits, or do you want to do lifestyle sessions? There's a whole bunch of things in there. So I would really just start to think about that. And that sort of needs to come from within. You know, you need to kind of follow your gut, but also follow your heart on that one. Because if you just fall into the trap of sort of being everything to everyone and not really having your own voice and expressing your own voice and your own vision and your own passion, that's a quick path to follow, you know, to get to that place that we talked about a few moments ago, where you'll start to fall out of love with it. You know, if you have these shoots that you line up and you're just like, oh gosh, I have to go photograph another dog. Like, I hate doing pet portraits. It's so boring. It doesn't fill me up. It doesn't excite me. And as soon as you start dreading that, no matter what, even if the money's coming in, you're going to fall out of love with photography. So I would say the best place to start, Cherry, is to like really understand what it is that you want to photograph and sort of start to build language around that, start to build a portfolio around that, start to build your sales around that and go find the market and, you know, build from there, build from your heart. And that way, you know, you're going to be fulfilled and feel excited and joy with what you're doing.
So would you think having a niche or a specific genre is important, or just, you know, shoot everything that's kind of related to that, or would you narrow it down?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I do not, and I have not subscribed to the mentality of needing to necessarily hyper niche down. I think it's something that a lot of educators in my industry have been teaching professional photographers for, I'd say, the better part of you know, 7 or 8 years. You know, this whole idea of, you know, only do this one thing, and you have to hyper focus, and you can only, you know, photograph for brides who are into fitness and who do this and who do that, and they go here and they get married at this venue and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that sounds great. And that whole idea of niching is attractive and sounds good when you've got someone on stage or someone behind a microphone or behind a video camera teaching that. But most of the time, when you kind of peel back the layers of that onion, you realize that person teaching that doesn't make a living doing that. They make a living teaching you and telling you to do that. And that is an interesting conundrum. So that whole idea of niching is in my opinion, it sounds nice and it works for those that can make it work. It's kind of like, you know, being a professional baseball player. It's like, yeah, for those that can get there, awesome, like amazing. There's nothing better than being able to do just one thing for one kind of person and being paid really well to do that. But right. most photographers will struggle with that. Most photographers will not be able to hyper niche and get really, really specific that way, especially in times like this, especially when, you know, the pickings are few and far between, you know, the clients are few and far between and things are becoming a little bit tighter. And I think this pandemic is going to drastically change the photography industry. And I think that the answer to how you can continue to adapt and even start up a business in that space or in the photography industry is to, you know, think about diversifying, but diversifying within your own bounds. And that's kind of what I talked about earlier, where like figure out what you want to photograph. Yes. Figure out, you know, how you want to express yourself and what you like to photograph and, you know, the kind of approach that you like to have, but feel free to have some flexibility in, you know, what you're photographing in that, or have a bit of, you know, shaping within that. But it's a fine balance. But I would say that hyper niching, I guess a long answer to your question, is probably not entirely necessary.
Yeah. So like, I know, like I had had some, when I started out, somebody recommended, you know, pick one thing and stick to it and all this. Well, I liked shooting families and I love shooting landscape and mm-hmm. I did both. But they kept saying, pick one. Well, I'm not going to pick one. You know, why should you pick one? Like, really?
Yeah, it's hard. Like, it's hard, right? That's the sort of, I guess that's where it depends. You know, if you want to get into being a, you know, photographer and quote unquote professional photographer, if you want to get in and start making a living, you've got to also, you know, balance out like, well, there's certain areas of photography that are perhaps a bit easier to make a living at. Like, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, if I'm here living in Niagara, I'm not going to make a living being a fashion photographer because the market's just not here. Here in Niagara, I'm not going to make a living being a fine art photographer necessarily, or being a landscape photographer. I can still do it, but I will probably have a hard time making a living doing it. Whereas I know here in Niagara, like weddings and families, no problem. So you definitely kind of have to do a bit of soul searching on that side of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. You're not going to win any fashion awards out here in rural Irma, Alberta.
I mean, it would be interesting, but I don't think you're going to have much work there.
No, none. But you will find oodles and oodles of families, weddings, that type of thing. Yep. Lots of that. And some, you will find some landscape work that people like, something that you've shot like locally and will want a print of that. And pretty much that's it. You're not going to find any work as a food photographer. You're not going to find any work as, what's another genre that there's no fashion, no food,
commercial, none of that. Editorial.
Yeah, probably not much of that.
Yeah.
So it's limited.
I think like an interesting sort of like exploration that, you know, our community can be looking to go into is potentially going into like the commissioned work direction. I mean, obviously, yes, if you know, if you like the idea of you know, bellies and babies and brides. Like that's a whole other niche, obviously, and I'm super familiar there. But our community, and I'm assuming Sherry, like on the podcast, it's mostly film photographers. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say yes. It would be okay. Mostly film photographers listening.
Okay. So what we do is pretty unique. Like I wouldn't say that, you know, film photography, while it's certainly, you know, in a bit of a heyday right now, and it's in a bit of a comeback, and it's, you know, for us in the community, it is, you know, more or less thriving for us in this niche of a community. But it's certainly not the norm. You know, like if I were to go and talk to my brother, who's a teacher, like he doesn't know anyone else that shoots film. Or if I were to talk to my in-laws, you know, they don't know anyone else that is photographing on film. So we've created a community, and we have a lot of folks that we talk to and know, but you know, to the average person, it's probably less than popular. And so I think in that there is a unique approach that we can take as film photographers, and we can sort of sell it, we can pitch it, we can explain sort of the value that we bring as film photographers, as being pretty unique, being pretty different from the average photographer. And I think that is potentially where the sort of commissioned work might make sense. You know, if you can get someone on board, and if you can communicate about what we do as film photographers in a way that is really attractive, I have found that's something that sort of gives you a bit of an edge. And so, you know, people will then come to you for that. And then we can hang our hats on making a living as a film photographer, which would be kind of fun.
It would be a lot of fun. Actually, I took a job a couple weeks ago for a family session, and they requested that I do half and half, half digital, half film. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sad to say this session never happened, as one of the family members passed away. So it's going to be rescheduled later on down the road, but yeah. But their main thing was, we want you to do some of us on film because that's really cool.
Yeah. And I think that is like really interesting to explore, like for us in terms of, you know, I say pitching, but pitching or selling or communicating, whatever the word is. But, you know, the analog aesthetic and the idea of analog is much more sort of intriguing and interesting and widely adopted by the general public. And so I think if we play that card, it definitely has more opportunity to sort of, you know, raise some eyebrows and perk some ears up. Because it is interesting and it is different. And so I think that if we sort of go in that direction, you know, I think when was this? Maybe back in the fall time, I had a client, who became a client, but someone got in touch and basically said that they had been following me and that, you know, they were loving the film work that I was doing. Having been a professional portrait photographer now for 15 years, like I've done a lot of boudoir photography. And she said, look, my boyfriend is, you know, really into, he's into, you know, he's in a band and he's really into like that analog aesthetic, you know, they're into, you know, records and all that stuff. And he's just, that's just like the sort of zone, that sort of like space that they're in as a couple and that they sort of live in. They're, you know, mid to late 20s. And she said, I'd love to do a boudoir session. But can you photograph it on black and white film? And I said, like, absolutely. And so, it was really cool because she gave me complete creative license to do what I do as a photographer. But do it on film. And that was really neat. And so I think that's just like the tip of the iceberg. I haven't really pushed that or tried to pursue that too much yet. But I think that's where there is some opportunity, where if we're looking at families or if we're looking at weddings or anything, I just think that there's a really neat opportunity there. I saw recently, I don't know, Sherry, if you're in the film photographers, sort of the Facebook group, it's just called Film Photographers. It's like, I don't know, 75,000 people in there. But
I think I am.
Yeah. So there's this photographer. I can't remember where he's from, but his name is Brian Smith, and fantastic photographer, just a beautiful photographer. I love his work. But he just shared the other day in that group that he captured his first 4x5 as a wedding portrait. Like, he went at a wedding that he was photographing and paid to photograph. He pulled out his Intrepid and he did a 4x5, a large format portrait of the bride and groom. And this portrait was like just stunning. Like, it was beautiful. And it was so uniquely 4x5. Like, you could tell it was large format. And I can just picture that being this beautiful darkroom print that the couple would have, and adding that service on, or if Brian had, you know, pitched that, or if he uses that to now get more business, I think it can become a niche for him. People can pay him for that, you know, analog approach to wedding photography. And I know that he does the same thing with like Super 8. He offers engagement session films on Super 8 for an upgrade fee. So I think that that's where, you know, we can kind of get creative with that business side and say, well, you know, the unique angle that we bring is this analog aspect to photography. And if we, again, communicate it the right way, I think that there's opportunity that folks would pay for that and potentially even pay more for that.
So I'm going to ask you now, most of the audience on this podcast, we are hobbyists. I am a hobbyist. Mm-hmm. I am a happy hobbyist. It's all good. But is there potential to have a part-time, not too much work involved, and be a hobbyist and select the jobs that you want and still be successful?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The wonderful thing about entrepreneurship is that you are the boss. And so when you're the boss, you can do what you want. Now, that is a blessing and a curse, right? Because, yeah, you know, those, and I can think of many, many times in my 15-year career as a photographer where, you know, some days you just kind of don't want to do the work. And there's no boss to hold me accountable to it. And so I have to have that motivation and drive within me to say, like, no, like, get out of your damn pajamas, get the cup of coffee going and get to work, like, get some stuff done. You got stuff to do. And that's like that. So it is a blessing and a curse. But I think, you know, the positives far outweigh the negatives. And so in that sense, you know, even if you wanted to do it and you know, do, I don't know, one commission a month, that's totally, totally fine. Again, I think the biggest part is just you have to learn how to communicate about what you do. And you need to find the people that will listen to that and will seek that. And then you can, you know, transition if you want to go, you know, very, very part-time and just do a commission a month or something like that. Like, you move in that direction of being sort of like a commissioned artist. And you know, you take clients on and you take them at the rate you want to take them, and you kind of have a bit of a waiting list. And that even in and of itself creates a bit of exclusivity. As you talk to clients and, you know, line these things up and start to set some expectations, you know, you can say, yeah, like, listen, that's like really wonderful. I would, you know, love to photograph your family. And I think photographing it on, you know, 6x6 black and white film will just be beautiful, and we'll do some darkroom prints for you. It's going to be stunning. Right now I'm booking about 3 months out. So if we want, we can go ahead and pick a date and a time for, you know, September. And, you know, we'll get in touch as we get closer to firm out some details. But I mean, you can approach it that way, and it never has to be, well, you know, I do this part time. And so, like, I don't know, like, it can be so much more. You can frame it in a much more refined way if you choose to. And that's where I think you say, you know, Sherry, with, you know, being successful, success is obviously very loosely defined as a broad sense, but everyone defines that in their own way. So once you've defined what that means for you and what kind of success you're seeking, you can make the steps and take the steps that are required to help you get there.
Okay. So in all of this, I see now how I've run into you is via social media. How important is social media?
Social media. You mean non-social media? I'm kidding. So I mean, social media is huge. It's sort of an, and it's interesting because when I started 15 years ago, it so it wasn't really even a thing, which is kind of like, my gosh, I feel like a freaking dinosaur saying that, like, our kids these days. But like 15 years ago, we didn't even have Facebook. And so like YouTube just became a thing type of thing. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's kind of crazy when you think about it, like it has changed so much. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, social media is just another channel of communication. So yes, like, you know, you want to put your work out there because there's folks that are out there that are looking for photographers and that are looking at hashtags or that are following people and so on and so forth. And so it's just another way to share work, to share your vision, to communicate with your audience, with your fans, with your clients. I think it's very important. Now, I mean, certainly there's some channels or there's some social media, you know, platforms that are probably better fit for different kinds of photographers and different kinds of markets that they want to go into. Instagram is certainly a very popular one because it's focused very heavily on photography. Facebook is still a popular one. I still get a lot of business. I've always gotten a lot of business from Facebook. So I would encourage, you know, folks listen here that want to get into that to check that out as a business opportunity. But really it's another way to share. It's another way to spread the word.
Would you say it's a daily thing that you have to spend, like, say, 15 minutes per day doing your social media?
I guess, like, to answer the question with, like, a yes or no answer, yes. But I'd say it's much more organic than that. Like, it's like if you were, you know, a photographer 30 years ago, like you'd go to the, or even, I mean, heck, even 15 years ago, you'd go to the business after five and you'd network with the local businesses and you would go to the BNI meetings and you would do the networking and like, you would do these things and you would go and exhibit at the fairs and, you know, you would do these things as just like a part of your, you know, make sure people know who I am and what I do, like plan. And that's what social media is. So I wouldn't say it's like as strict as like, you know, you need to put in your social media time and more so like it just needs to become a part of your pattern. It needs to become a part of your routine to just be there and to be social and to be interacting with folks and to be sharing your work and putting your name out there. Because if you don't put your name out there, no one's going to know who you are and what you do. And then it's going to be pretty darn hard to be able to, you know, make any kind of income from photography.
So you just mentioned like the community fair, like do you think donating time to a community event is helpful?
Yeah.
Getting
going? Absolutely. I mean, there are so many ways to get your name out there into the market. Social media is really just such a small piece of the bigger picture. It's important to, you know, to again, and that's where we started, where it's like, well, what kind of photography are you doing? You know, if you're getting into family portraits, well, you need to start thinking, who are the families that I want to be working with and what do they do? Where do they go? Where do they shop? Where do they spend their free time? You know, Saturday mornings, where do they go? And so those are the kinds of things that you need to be then brainstorming and saying, well, how can I be there too? How can I be in front of them? If that means exhibiting at the local cafe, great. If that means going to the home show, great. If that means advertising on this, you know, local TV station, great. Like there's so many different ways in addition to social media that you can get your name out there. Even if it's like, you know, getting involved in a mom to mom group or teaching a photography class or writing a column in the local newspaper, like whatever it is, there's so many ways to get your name out there. Social media is just sort of one of them.
But I guess what I'm meaning is like, say there's a function, say like the local 4-H day. Do you think it would be worth your time to pick up your camera, go out there, take pictures of the kids with their animals or their projects and just give them to them? Is that something that you feel would be getting your name out there?
like potentially for sure. I mean, I think that there needs to be obviously like a lot of like exploration into that to see if it actually makes sense. But beyond that, I think there needs to be a lot of intentionality behind it. Like if let's say, for example, you know, I guess maybe let me answer the question with the question, and then I can maybe dig deeper. Explain more about like what this event is and what you'd be trying to get out of it.
Okay.
So just as an example, as like an illustration.
Okay, so the event is the local 4-H day, and the kids have worked all day, all year, with, say, a cow to raise the cow up, and then they're judged on it at the end of this day. So they're there with their cow and with themselves, and they're showing their animal to the judge. Now, would this be something that it's a community event? Most of the town is there because we're a small rural town. Yep. Is this something that would be worth donating your time to document for them?
Okay, I got it. So, yes, but again, there needs to be a lot of intentionality behind it. So what I would do if I were like, you know, coaching you on this, because I do business coaching. So what I would do is I would say, get in touch with the folks who organize it and tell them that you would like to become a sponsor of the event. And I'm sure that they have other sponsors, you know, whether it's the animal food companies. I'm not super familiar, but you know, I'm sure they have lots of sponsors. You know, you want to get involved with the event, you want to sponsor. And basically what you'd like to do is, you know, provide photojournalistic coverage of the day so that, you know, there's a nice document of what's happening. And of course, you know, you and I would approach it and say, we'd want to do that on film. but you know, we want to do this, you know, really beautiful documentation of the day. We'd love to perhaps exhibit the work, from that coverage for the year at the local library or wherever, the local town hall, that kind of thing, so that folks can come on in and sort of, you know, relive that for a year until the next event. Maybe we're going to do darkroom prints of that. So we're going to do these beautiful, you know, things, and you make a little event out of the unveiling of it. And maybe, you know, whoever wins this, or if there's, you know, three winners or two winners, you know, each of them is going to be gifted, sort of part of their prize. They're going to be gifted a portrait session with you, with their animal. So, and again, I might be messing up a lot of the details here, but you know, you get to, you know, go and photograph them at some mutually convenient time. And again, maybe you're going to go and you're going to do, you know, 3 4x5, frames with them. And so that's the prize if you're doing an analog approach to it. And then you're going to, you know, make this really beautiful darkroom print, and that's what they're going to get, and you're going to frame it for them. But obviously, like, in that arrangement, so now you've sort of become a little bit more official than just like, I'm going to bring my camera and take pictures. Because if you just bring your camera and take pictures, no one knows who you are still. Like, that doesn't change anything. So if you can get involved with the event in a bigger way and, you know, say that, you know, you are donating a prize, or the winner gets this prize, this portrait session with this local film photographer, it sort of just creates that sort of ambiance or that sort of general feeling of, you know, more officialness, more luxury, more professionalism. And then again, if you make an event out of the unveiling of the gallery or the exhibit afterwards, then that can also be another thing, and get the local newspaper involved and get the local mayor involved and things like that. And then of course, maybe your name can also be in the program for the event, and they can, you know, print up a sign and that kind of thing. And if anyone, you know, is interested in having portraits done, you know, you're offering a complimentary 8x10 print, darkroom print from a portrait session included at no cost, normally, you know, $175, if they wanted to book you because they saw your name at that event. So right. There's a whole bunch of things. Like, that's just kind of like off the top of my head, but there's a whole bunch of ways that you'd want to approach it so that the effort is worth it. You know, like, you're getting some name recognition, you're getting your name out there a little bit, you're elevating the brand a little bit, you're giving back, and you're involved in this way. So it's like, it has this, not philanthropic approach, but it has this sort of community give back feeling to it. But it's not like you're just going to like show up with a camera, snap some pics, and here's a gallery. Like, it has some more some more professional luxury appeal to it. So that would probably be like, you know, in a matter of 5 minutes, sort of what I would advise in that sort of situation.
Okay. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So donating your time to a community event with some intention is a good thing.
Oh, gotcha. 100%. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge opportunity.
So, another venue that I've always wondered about is stock photography. So what are your opinions on that, Brian?
Yeah. So, I mean, stock photography, there's definitely like an opportunity there. Like definitely I know of some photographers that do decently well there. The nice thing is that obviously it's passive income. But it's tricky, you know, like it's a lot of photographers, you know, will just put stuff up there and, you know, they'll get a check at the end of the year for like 10 cents and they're like, yay. So it's tricky. I mean, you have to be on trend. You have to know what companies are looking for when they're purchasing stock photography. You've got to, you know, really get your work out there. You're shooting all in spec. So you're having to, you know, pay for your own shoots and line up all that kind of stuff. And those are the kinds of shoots that are the kinds of stock photography images that do well. But it's a bit of a risk and it's a bit of a leap up front. So I wouldn't say it's where a photographer should start, but certainly, you know, there's potentially opportunity there.
Right, right. I am entirely familiar with the 10-cent check. I think last year's was 50 cents. Ooh, I did good.
There you go.
To be fair, though, the pictures that I have put up on stock are things where I have set them up. They're a still life, and I was learning how my strobes worked. So it's an exciting picture of a glass of milk and Oreo cookies where, you know, it's not going to do anything sitting on my hard drive, so at least it's going to make me the 50 cents on stock.
There you go.
Every once in a while that it sells, but I don't have many up there, but it's not a get-rich scheme. Is there any way that people can, you know, set up a better stock photo portfolio?
Again, it's one of those things where it's like you really need to sort of dive into that space. You've got to be, you know, learning about what the trends are in stock photography, because they change every couple of months in terms of what folks are looking for. And when I say folks, like, you know, the people that buy stock photography, you know, what people are buying from stock photography agencies. And so you've got to really, you know, build an understanding there and get in and learn them and understand them and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's doable, but it's a lot. We've done a number, if you want, Sherry, to like link our podcast, I've done a number of interviews, with some of the, you know, head people at Adobe Stock or some of the other stock photography agencies, to kind of dig deeper into that topic, to sort of give some advice on how photographers can do well there. But definitely they're more the expert at speaking to that than I would be.
So speaking of your podcast, let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. So it's called The Business of Photography, and for 450 or something odd episodes, we've been talking about the business of photography. So basically, between, you know, interviews where I bring on other, you know, colleagues and other professional photographers or just business experts in general, I kind of bring them on and just dig deep into the business side of what we do and, you know, going into a very specific area. Usually, like, we keep it very focused for each topic, or for each episode is focused on one topic. So we'll, you know, go into one specific idea as it relates to social media marketing, or one specific idea as it relates to selling, or one specific idea as it relates to branding. And so you can kind of pick and choose which episodes make sense for you. They're all not timely, in the sense that like episode one is as relevant today as it was when I recorded it 5 years ago, because we, you know, pick a topic, dive into it, talk about strategy, give specifics, give tactics, but it's never about, you know, the news or what's happening and things like that. So, that's it. But I mean, in any of the podcast apps that you listen to, you can just search for The Business of Photography and I'm sure you'll find us.
I do listen to it, but I'm not up to date. I am not up to date on any of the podcasts right now. Shame on me.
We've had a lot less time to be traveling through this madness. And so, I'm in the same boat, Sherry.
It's summertime and it's nice out and you want to be outside, not listening to stuff. So I have to say, come fall, that will change and I will probably get caught right back up.
I listen to podcasts when I like cut the grass and things like that, but my yard isn't big enough so I can only get through, you know, one episode of Negative Positives or one episode of something else. So yeah, for sure. Definitely less time without all the travel and the driving. I'm finding I have less time for podcasts.
Funny you were talking about mowing grass. I was mowing grass on the weekend and 4 hours later, I'm still not done. And I have a 61-inch mower.
See, so what's your excuse for not listening to podcasts?
I was listening to podcasts. I got caught up on some of them.
Okay, good.
Not all of them.
There you go.
So I have one question here for you.
Yes.
Okay, so you are stranded in the backwoods within a cottage for 1 month, and you have one digital camera, one film camera, and one film stock, and all the chemistry and film you can shoot. What are they?
Oh, okay. Digital camera. I have my Fuji X100V. I love that camera. And so that's the digital, that's my sort of daily shooter on the digital side of things. I love that camera. On the film side, oh geez, I have my Rolleiflex 2.8C Zenitar lens, and I'm shooting Ektar on it.
Okay, sounds good. That was short and sweet here. I thought you would have 10 choices to pick from.
Oh, you know, it's hard. You know, it was between that or my I've got a Leica M6 and I've got a 50 millimeter Summicron collapsible lens, and I love the character out of that lens. But if I'm stranded by myself, I love my M6 for, you know, documenting the kids and quick things like that. If I'm doing still life or landscape or architecture or you know, macro stuff and all that, I've got Rolinars on my Rolleiflex. I can bring my Rolinars, right? That's okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay, good. Then yeah. I think my Rolleiflex is probably gonna be my choice.
Yeah. So I seen here, was it just a few days ago, you had posted that you weren't happy with one of your Rolleiflexes because the meter wasn't working.
I'm so type A. It's ridiculous. So it's funny. Long story short, a very long story short, I bought a 2.8D and I love it. It's awesome. There's no meter in that camera. So it's perfect. It's fine. And then I saw a guy in one of the Facebook, and this is the problem with Facebook. Social media doesn't get me business. It loses me money. So I saw a guy who had a 2.8E who was selling it, and he had two Rolinars, the two that I wanted, and a couple filters with it, and he wouldn't split it. I just wanted the Rolinars because they're like impossible to find for Bay 3, and I couldn't find them, and so he had them, and it was actually a really, really fair price. So he wouldn't split them, and I said, okay, well, I'll buy the whole thing from you then, and I'll sell off the camera. In the meantime, while that was being shipped to me, it was from Brazil, so it was taking a while. A buddy of mine told me he, you know, I told him about all this and he's like, well, I'll buy your 2.8D off you then. I said, okay, sure. So I sold him my 2.8D knowing that the 2.8E was on its way and just figured I'd shoot with that. And then of course, along the way, the meter breaks on the 2.8D, the little plastic cover on the side broke off, and it must've gotten lodged in the meter. And those things they're pretty fickle. Like it's an old, you know, it's a Selenium meter, but it's a pretty fickle little matte needle system. And so it must've, you know, broken something inside of there and I couldn't get it fixed. And so I could have either just lived with it, with a broken meter, which it would have been the same as my 2.8D. But I'm like way too type A to have a camera, such a beautiful vintage piece of history, with a piece in it that doesn't work. So even though I probably wouldn't have used the meter, I just couldn't live with it being broken. And so I'm going to be listing that. And in the meantime, totally by chance, totally by fluke, I was meeting up with someone else about something unrelated at a local camera store. And I go inside and they have this mint condition, beautiful 2.8C, which is, for anyone that knows the Rolleiflex sort of lineup, it's the 10 blade aperture one, and it's a Zenitar lens. And it was in mint condition optically and mechanically and cosmetically. And Joan, the owner there, had it listed for a really, really fair price. And so I said, damn it. I said, I'm going to get it and I'll sell off this E. So that's where I am now. And I'm very happy with it. And it's not going anywhere.
Well, hey, don't feel bad. I have two Rolleys myself.
There you go.
And I know how you feel. And one is the 1938 Automat.
Okay, yep.
And I found out, I was told it wasn't a very valuable camera, but I still got it a CLA because it's old.
Yeah, for sure.
And I wanted to shoot with it. And so yeah. I got it fixed up. And then I find out that it's actually kind of a rare camera.
Okay.
There were only 20,000 made, and then the war hit.
Ah, see?
And so I thought, oh, okay, well, I guess that was worth fixing up. But I also have my 3.5F.
Yep, that's a nice camera, too.
It is. And yes, my meter works, and no, I don't use it.
It's so funny. I've been back and forth, like, because, you know, of what I photograph a lot of the times, portraits and my kids, it's, you know, somewhat usually faster moving. Even though I definitely do slow down when I'm photographing with the Rolleiflex. I kind of like the idea of having an onboard meter just to kind of get me in the right direction a bit quicker. But after just kind of some playing around and some researching, I just figured, you know what, I'm okay with an external meter.
You know, I was actually thinking of this the other day. I said, I should just go and try a couple shots and see if that meter is actually accurate. Maybe it's out to lunch. Yes, the needle moves, but I haven't really tested it.
See, I had that problem. I had met up with someone. He had a 2.8F for sale, again, for a really good price. And I was interested, but I said, if I'm going to get it, I'm not going to have the same problem that I had with my 2.8E. That meter needs to work and it needs to be accurate if I'm going to get it. And so I met up with them and I tested it. And I was outside. I was in a parking lot and it was sunny. And I set the ISO to 100. And I set, well, no, and then I guess because it's got the coupled thing. Mm-hmm. So I pointed at the light and I see the needle moving and I'm like, okay, this is good. You know, I'm pointing it towards a sunny area. But when I got the needle, the little red one matched up with what the meter was saying, it was telling me f2.8 1/60th of a second. And I said, no, this is bright sun. Like, I'm pointing it at the bright sun. This is nowhere close to like f2.8 at 1/60th of a second at ISO 100. So I tested it in a couple other situations. I went into the shade and it was like way off. It must have been 6 or 7 stops off. So I said, yeah, no, that's not going to work for me. So I didn't go for it.
Yeah, yeah. Who knows? You know, they are a selenium meter. And just because it has been CLA'd recently doesn't mean that it is going to be accurate.
Well, and I mean, the thing is like selenium meters, like, yes, they're old and yes, they, you know, sort of have a bit of a life, like a life to them in the sense of like they're not going to necessarily, well, I mean, they might last forever, but, you know, they're definitely more fickle and you see more, you know, Fs and Es that have meters that don't work than you do that have them working. But I've got a number of cameras that have selenium meters in them that, you know, seem to work okay. So I was kind of hoping, and he was saying, you know, it reacts to light and all that. And it's like, okay, well, maybe it'll be fine. But alas, it does not work.
Well, I have the Olympus EE. Yep. That's the half frame. It works fine.
Yeah.
It just needs a darn good cleaning. It's a little gritty.
Yeah.
And yep. I have an Olympus Trip. It works fine.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And
I have the EES 2, which is basically the half frame version of the trip, and it's like beautiful in terms of like the meter working and it being accurate and everything.
And I even took it out in snow and it worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like snow is tough.
Snow is tough.
You know this.
Oh, yes. I mean, I usually sort of overcompensate. I overexpose by a stop or two if I'm shooting in the snow, but I still haven't had any problems with it. Like with that EES-2, it works wonderfully.
I know on the EE, you can't pick. It's the point and shoot, basically. So getting
it to... Does it have the... It's got the DX code reading then? Is that how it chooses ISO?
I think it's too old for that. I picked the ISO.
Okay, yeah. So that's what I do then, is I just kind of... I fake overexpose it by choosing a different ISO.
I do too. And I do that on all my consumer film.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah.
Not the professional lines, but all of the consumer stuff gets an extra stop.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes out beautifully, and I like the look, and...
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I'm not looking forward on Frugal Films coming up. We're having our film change. It's Ektar.
Oh.
And
You're not looking forward. What are you not looking forward to Ektar?
I have a love-hate with Ektar.
Oh, no.
It's either it's awesome and amazing, or it's horrific.
Oh, I absolutely love Ektar.
There's no in-between. So I was wondering, you know, I was thinking maybe if I get a polarizing filter, that might help.
You know what I find? I don't like Ektar in shade. I like it best when there's sun, when there's contrast. I find if it's flat lighting, it almost looks HDR to me. Like, I don't like how it looks if it's flat lighting. So I like contrast in a scene, whether that be sun or just natural contrast. And I shoot it at 50. I always shoot it at 50.
Have you ever tried shooting it at 400 and pushing it too?
I have shot it at 100 and pushed it one stop. So I haven't tried pushing it two stops, but I have shot it a fair bit, actually. I'll meter it at 100 and develop it by pushing it one stop, so pushing it to 200, but always overexposing that by one stop.
Right. So I'm just going to put it – last time I shot it at box speed, and it was in Mexico, so I'd never shot it there before, and it was slightly overcast, and I thought these are all going to look like garbage. But it was already in the camera, so I had no choice. And I also had limited cameras to pick from. But they came out beautiful, and I was quite shocked. Like, the colors were vibrant. Like, yes, it was overcast. But if I would have done that here at home, it would have just been bleh.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you definitely have to find the right way to shoot it and the right thing to shoot with it. But when you get it right, it's a beautiful emulsion.
You know, I have to wait until the sun gets bright enough, and we've got 3 days of overcast skies in the forecast, so that's not going to happen. So, yeah, I was wondering, you know, if maybe a polarizing filter would help.
Yeah, check it out. I've never shot with one on film, so I couldn't say.
I have before. I did it last year on the project, but with Kodak Gold. It was gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just, I don't know what it was, but it made the blues bluer and the greens greener. And I thought, you know, if it worked so well on the gold, maybe that's what I need for the Ektar to make it so I love it.
Give it a shot. I like Kodak Gold too. It's a nice film.
It is. And I can buy that here.
There you go. It's hard to find, actually.
Oh, no, that's all I can buy here.
Oh, really? Okay. It's cheap too.
It's cheap too. It's $12.88. No, they went up 98 cents for three rolls of 24.
That's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get you to ship me some of that then.
Just go into Walmart, Brian. That's where I buy it.
Oh, yeah. No, we don't have it at Walmart here.
You don't? Oh, no, if you want some, I'll send you some. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the place where the camera store where I buy all my film usually. It's $17.40 for a three pack.
It's probably a 36, so.
Nope, 24.
Oh, same thing. Wow.
Yeah. Now with that company, I get 25% off because I buy enough film, but still it's $13. What'd you say yours was?
$12.98.
Okay. So
plus GST, but we don't have no PST.
Oh, see? All right. Well, we're going to have to hook up then. Do you ever come across Fuji Color C200 or no?
Not very often, no.
Oh, okay. That's my favorite color film. I love that film.
I'm not even sure if I have any of that. I know I have a freezer full. Oh, yes, I have some in the deep freeze, but it's Superior. Is that the same thing?
Oh, Superior. No, not the same thing. No, the C200 is the 200 speed film. I think Superior is 400.
Oh, no, there's Superior 200 as well.
Oh, is there Superior 200? Okay. Maybe it's, I don't think it's the same emulsion, but maybe it is.
It probably isn't. I know I bought a bunch before it went up in price in the States and just put it in my deep freeze.
Yeah, there you go.
So I still have the old green boxes, but they've been froze since they've been bought, so they'll be good for a long time.
Nice.
And slowly, that and my Agfa Vista are sitting in that box.
I've never shot Agfa Vista.
Oh, I love that film. I was so sad when it went.
Yeah. At least we're getting new films come out. Piranha is coming out 120. Actually, I just read that. So it's coming out in 120, which is super exciting.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. I'm I'm waiting for the day that Double X comes out in 120 because I will buy stock in that company when that happens.
Well, you should hook up with Andre because he knows a little bit about something like that.
It's on record now. I'm going to have to message him and say, hey, wait a minute. When is this coming out, 120? Give me some rules of this. I'll beta test it for you guys.
He knows a little something about Double X and 120. Possibly coming out here in the future, so.
Okay, well, I'm going to message him.
And since your show is right after his, the cat is already out of the bag, so.
Did he announce something on the show?
Possibly.
No. Oh, now I'm messaging him right now. I'm saying I'm on a call.
not 100% yet, but it is in the works. They are going to be looking at doing Double X in 120.
Okay, I just messaged him. Andre, if you're listening, this is Brian from the past. We're talking. Good stuff. Good stuff. That's exciting.
Awesome. I'm so happy that they're going ahead and doing some new things. You know, I know lots of people have been looking for Double X in 120.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's a popular choice for a lot of people.
Oh, it's like, it's without a question my favorite black and white film.
I have two rolls sitting in the dark room that I have to develop and I haven't done it yet. And they're the first two rolls I've ever shot.
Oh, so you haven't even developed any yet?
I haven't developed it yet. I've shot it, but I have to go and develop it. I don't know why I've been just dragging my feet developing my black and white lately.
Okay.
But hopefully this week.
Check it out. Yeah, it's such a beautiful film.
I've heard nothing but good things about it, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even nicer in 120.
Now that I got your attention, hey?
There you go.
So I guess we've probably been chatting for a good hour here. I guess we should get our socials out. So if you would mind telling people where they can find you.
Yeah, for sure. So if you want to find me on Instagram, it is bcapphoto, bcapphoto. If you want to check out my photography site, bcapphoto.com. If you're interested in Sprout at all, you can just go to getsproutstudio.com. That's pretty much everywhere you can find me.
Okay. And are you also on Facebook?
I am. Yes. Just my name, Brian Capricci. Or if you're in the negative positives group, I'm over there too all the time.
Yes. Anyway, so you can also find me here on the podcast. You can find me on Instagram at embrace_the_grain, or you can send me an email at embracethegrainpodcast@gmail.com, or you can buy me a cup of coffee over on Ko-Fi. That's ko-fi/embracethegrainpodcast. And I guess that is it for this week. And everybody stay positive and embrace the grain. See you next week. Bye, Brian. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.